Those who can, do. Those who cannot, do it on the internet. FancyPantsGangsters.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Voice Behind, the show for actors who are heard but not seen. And this week, it's rare that we get someone whose real name sounds like one of the characters he voices. And you got to like a man with the name of Crispin Freeman. Thank you for coming on the show, sir.
Well, thank you for having me, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Looking at your IMDb list and your Wikipedia page and all that stuff, you have a very intimidating CV in terms of just the sheer volume of roles that you've had. You know, I guess in front of the mic and behind it, I guess would be one way to put it, which we'll definitely talk about. We've got to start at the beginning. Now, you were a Midwestern kid raised in Illinois.
Yes, actually raised in Illinois and Montana, sort of back and forth between the two.
And you always wanted to be an actor?
You know, I fell in love with acting when I was in middle school. My family was heavily involved with the opera when I was young, and they suggested when I was a young child that I try out to be an extra at the opera, where basically, you know, as long as I fit the costume, they would put me on stage and I just stand there and be set dressing. Well, I initially resisted it because I was a very shy young child, and that sounded sort of scary getting up in front of people on stage. But once I finally agreed to do it, I fell in love with being backstage, especially at an opera house, which is a pretty magical place. And I became so enamored of creating the illusion for the audience that I did it all through middle school. And then when I was in high school, a freshman in high school, I was too old to be a kid at the opera. That's when I started auditioning for plays during my high school years. And luckily, I started getting into them and started taking acting class. And that's sort of when the acting bug really bit me.
Was the intention to do something along the lines of voice acting? Or was it just you wanted to act?
Oh, not at all. I had no conception of voice acting. That didn't really enter into my worldview because my experience was theater. And so I was a committed theater actor, and I majored in theater in college and minored in computer science. And then I went off to get a Master's of Fine Arts at Columbia and in theater acting. And that's what I was doing in New York. I was thinking about also doing film and television work. I thought at some point I might move to L.A. or try to do that work as well. But while I was in New York, I was put in touch with some studios that worked on Japanese animation. And that had also been a passion of mine since I'd been a child. And so I started working on the animation stuff in New York and then realized I was getting more excited about the animation than I was about the theater. I should be pursuing this animation thing. And so it wasn't until years after grad school and working on Broadway and off-Broadway and regionally and whatnot that I thought, you know, let me pursue this animation and this voiceover thing more full time. And that's when I moved out to Los Angeles.
Now, you said before when asked about your kind of your early inspiration was particularly with anime, that you were big fans of Voltron, Star Blazers, and Robotech in specific. Now, what's interesting to me about that is maybe this is just my interpretation, but neither of those shows or none of those shows were really well known for voice acting. What about those shows really kind of drew you in terms of acting?
Well, they didn't necessarily draw me in because of the acting. They drew me in because of the story. And you have to understand that now we live in a smorgasbord of animation storytelling choices. Basically, any animated series you can think of, you can probably access somehow, either through Netflix, DVDs, or some other way. But back then, the only way I had access to animation was what was broadcast. And the majority of stuff that was being broadcast, especially when I was young, was Tom and Jerry, Woody Woodpecker, Scooby-Doo, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, whatever was on Saturday morning cartoons. And so into this mix was thrown every once in a while these really interesting shows like Speed Racer, Star Blazers, Voltron, Battle of the Planets, Robotech. And these shows had such a different style and such a different storytelling sensibility. And I love them. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I realized what was common among them all was that they were Japanese. It wasn't until Robotech that I thought, oh, this feels different because it comes from a different country. And so that was my sort of initial fascination, was the storytelling appealed to me so heavily. So when I was able to get back into Japanese animation after high school, during college I lost touch with it because we didn't really have much media when I was in college. The internet existed, and I was a computer science hacker, but the World Wide Web did not exist until 1995, and I graduated in 1994. So there wasn't a whole lot of media online that you could get access to, and there was certainly no decent television where I was at in the Massachusetts mountains. So it wasn't until I got to New York City where there was a concentration of enough people that they actually had anime stores where you could walk in and buy anime on VHS tape. And so it wasn't until then that I was sort of reintroduced to Japanese animation. And I thought, wow, there's a lot more than I even realized existed when I was young. And initially, I was really not fond of the English dubs of these shows. I thought they were not very good. This was back in the sort of early and mid-90s. But then I realized that all the shows I had watched as a kid were dubbed. That was my introduction to anime. And so I wanted to make that introduction as good as possible. So that's why I started getting into the industry, to see if I could sort of raise the level of quality for dubs of Japanese animation. And then that expanded into doing voiceover of all types. So in terms of voice actors that I admired when I was young, the first voice actors that I was probably aware of in any meaningful sense were the voice actors who worked on the animated version of The Hobbit. Hans Conried as Thorin Oakenshield, Brother Theodore as Gollum. These were the first voices that I was aware of thinking, wow, those are really cool voices, and I like their performances. But then again, The Hobbit was my absolute favorite story growing up. So you already had me on one level because the story was going to appeal to me. But that was probably the first thing that I was aware of where I thought, wow, those voices sort of fascinate me. But the hook for me was not necessarily the acting, but the storytelling.
I was going to ask you about your opinion of English dubs for anime. And so you were approaching it, your initial concern was a quality issue, not some sort of like hipstery, you know, the original's always the best kind of mentality. Is that correct?
Yeah. I realized you have to also remember that back during the VHS era, dubs outsold subtitled VHS tapes 10-1. So the majority of people back then were consuming anime in English dub form. And so sometimes a show would live or die in terms of its distribution based on the sales of those VHS tapes. So I wanted to make sure that these shows had a life. Because if they got distribution, they would get distributed both as dub and sub. But if the dubs didn't sell, they didn't get distributed at all. So I wanted at least there to be an option. And then when DVDs were invented, then it's sort of simple. It's like, well, both are on one disc. So you can just push a button and decide which one you prefer to watch. So it was never a question of what was superior. It was a question of will it exist at all if it doesn't have some sort of life in the marketplace.
What do you say to fans, anime fans now, that may feel that, you know, feel for whatever reason that one particular is better than the other, particularly, you know, Japanese versus English?
Well, that's their prerogative. I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion, and they're entitled to watch a show however they want. And they should just know that all Japanese animation is dubbed, whether it's dubbed by the Japanese or dubbed by Americans or dubbed by anyone. The animation is done first, and then the actors perform to animation that already exists. Now, ostensibly, the animation was animated for the Japanese language, but if you've ever watched many animated shows from Japan, notice the Japanese are not quite the sticklers for matching lip flap. The Americans or even the French are. The French have a long history of dubbing all kinds of visual media, and they're really good at it. So the Japanese are going through the same process that anyone else is. It's not like in America, where American animation studios tend to record the audio of the voice actor's performance first, and then the animators create the visual animation based on that audio performance. That's not the way it works in Japan. The animation is done first, and whoever is going to provide the voice must match animation that already exists. And I remember talking to Yoko Kanno, who was the composer for Cowboy Bebop, Escaflowne, and a whole number, Wolf's Rain, a whole number of other amazing anime shows. We met back in 1999. And she said once about Cowboy Bebop, she said, our spike, meaning the Japanese spike, good. Your spike, meaning the American spike, oh, sexy. From her perspective, one was not necessarily superior to another. They were just a different flavor. And I remember early in the dubbing history, there was an anime series called You're Under Arrest. And the director, the Japanese director of You're Under Arrest, actually said that he preferred the English dub to the Japanese version because he thought that the English dub had really gotten the sense of the storytelling and the characters better than the Japanese version had. So it totally depends. I think what historically the challenge has been, America has not had as much a history of dubbing animation as other countries. So we had a longer learning curve to getting our performances, our production practices, and everything else up to a level that starts to approach other countries like Japan and France, who have had a much longer tradition of doing that kind of work. It's taken longer to get to that level. And it depends. It's a sort of show-by-show case. It's a case-by-case situation, whether a show's dub is really, really good or whether a show's dub is not so good. There are some shows I have a hard time watching Cowboy Bebop in Japanese because I've gotten so attached to the American English version. And certainly the work that we did in Wolf's Rain, I think, is some of the finest dubbing work that I've ever heard anywhere. And that's not just because I'm in it. That's because... Elizabeth and the other actors in it are fantastic, including the voice actor who plays Quinn, the older guy who sort of spends most of the show drunk and trying to hunt down wolves and nobody believes him. I mean, the actor playing that character just steals the damn show. He's so amazing. So I think it's everyone's entitled to their preferences and they should be able to watch the animation however they choose.
We've talked to several people that have done voicing in anime and voicing in video games as well, which you've done quite a bit as well. And one kind of weird common thread that they seem to have, at least of the people we've talked to so far, is that they like doing anime, but they're not necessarily fans on their own. They may have become familiar with it as they're doing it, but it's not something that they seek out. You seem to be the opposite side, where you're very much an anime fan. So from that perspective, what is your favorite show that you've worked on, just either from the perspective of just having the most fun doing it, but also just as an anime fan, just what is the most fun to watch?
That's an interesting question. I think that probably my favorite show to work on, both in terms of my own artistic satisfaction of what it was like as an actor, and also my satisfaction in terms of watching it as an audience member, is probably the anime Wolf's Rain. That project was sort of a dream come true to me. I was in New York when I first heard the English dub of Cowboy Bebop, and I thought, wow, those people are good. I want to work with them. It was one of the large motivating factors for me moving to Los Angeles. And synchronicity came into play, and I actually met the voice director, Mary Elizabeth, at a convention. And she said, absolutely, I'd love to work with you in Los Angeles if you ever move out here. So that because of that and many other reasons, I decided to move out to LA. And when I got there, Cowboy Bebop was over. I didn't have a chance to work on it. But there was this new show coming down the pike called Wolf's Rain. And it was done by the same animation studio. It had the same character designer. It had the same musical composer. It was a different director. But it was also the same dubbing studio. It was the same recording studio and the same dubbing producers. And Mary Elizabeth was directing again. And the one thing that Wolf's Rain had that Cowboy Bebop did not was that it had a deep mythological storyline, which has always been a sort of passion of mine, even before I was consciously aware of it. I have a passion for mythological storytelling and archetypal hero journeys. And so here was Wolf's Rain, which was going right along that path. So it was sort of a fetish come true, shall we say, that all of this combined together and that I was able to play one of the main characters in the show.
Now, as I've mentioned, you've done quite a bit of anime. Just, again, go to the Wikipedia for... I'm assuming there's even more out there than what is already covered. But you've also done stuff for... You did Ponyo on the Cliff, and you also did Howl's Moving Castle. Now, both of those were produced by Disney. What was the... Was there a difference in terms of how they approached the recording sessions, given that they're Disney, versus some of the other anime stuff that you've done?
Yes, well, they pay better. Which is very nice of them. But the other difference is that Disney works... let's see. There is an industry of dubbing anime that has grown up, and there are studios and producers that have developed different methods of production and working on anime over the years. Disney didn't have that kind of experience with anime per se, and they didn't necessarily know how those people did it. So they treated it the way you would do the dubbing for any film that had a character that was never on screen. There's a division of Disney called Disney Character Voices, and their job is to make sure that the characters, Disney characters, sound consistent from film to film. They make sure that Mickey sounds like Mickey and Goofy sounds like Goofy. And sometimes what happens is they'll get called on to do things like Narnia. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is mostly a live-action film with a lot of special effects. But there is this character of Aslan, who is a major character in the film, but he's not played by an actor in the flesh. Liam Neeson is doing his voice. And so that fell to Disney Character Voices to cast and record and work into the film. So they basically just handed them all the Miyazaki films that they had made a deal with Miyazaki to distribute in the U.S. And so Disney Character Voices sort of swooped in and started trying to cast these films and work on their production. One of the big things they did differently is they have what's called a large ADR stage. Most anime historically has been recorded in small booths in post-production houses. These are booths that are designed usually just for voiceover. They're about the size of a large walk-in closet, sometimes even smaller. And that's usually how they're done at more sort of smaller studios. Disney has these huge, what are called ADR rooms, automatic dialogue replacement, or looping rooms, which sometimes you use when you have to put in the background voices for crowds and whatnot. So you walk in, you have to walk onto the Disney lot to work on these projects, and you walk into this room that's the size of a movie theater. It's actually quite large, and you're staring up at a large movie screen, like a full movie screen. And so it's you all by yourself in this large sort of cavernous space. They're usually using a couple of microphones. The director may or may not be in the room with you, or they may be in a control room talking to you over headphones. And the big difference was that they had a visual cue. You may or may not be familiar with the idea that when we're usually dubbing anime in Los Angeles, there are three beeps that cue us. Three beeps in succession, beep, beep, beep. And where the fourth imaginary beep would sound, that's when your character's mouth opens on the screen. So it's like a conductor telling you when to come in to do your part. Well, when I first came to do Howl's Moving Castle, which was the first project I did with Disney, the beeps were there, but there were also all these white lines running across the screen on this huge movie screen. And it was really initially quite distracting. I was like, wow, what a terrible video print. Like, why did they get such an awful video print of the movie to use for the... And then I realized the lines were mimicking the beeps. There would be one line on the left-hand side of the screen, and there'd be another white line on the right-hand side. And as the beeps would go, the line on the right would slide across the screen until it would line up with the line on the left. So basically, it was a visual cue about when to speak, as well as an auditory cue. And it took me the, you know, like a second or two to realize that's what was going on. And I thought, oh, well, that's cute. I've never been in a studio that had a video generator sophisticated enough to be able to give me a visual cue when to speak, as not as well as an auditory cue. So that was sort of interesting. I also think that they were using a lot of actors who may not have been as familiar with doing ADR work. So they scheduled a lot of time for me to do my part in Howl's Moving Castle. It's actually quite short. And I got it done in 15 minutes. And they looked at me like I was crazy. They're like, you've done this before, haven't you? I was like, yeah, I've sort of done a lot of this. You've probably been working with film actors who maybe aren't as fast as this. But us voiceover people, we're usually pretty good at this stuff. So should we have a coffee, talk about Miyazaki?
Now, you've also done a ton of video games and a lot of anime-related ones, but also, you know, just video games. Are you a big gamer yourself?
You know, it's interesting. I am very selective in my gaming. What'll happen is I will get sort of obsessed with one game and binge on it for a while, like over a weekend, and then I'll stop, and then I won't touch it for months, and then I'll go back and binge on it again. So yes, I am a gamer, but my experience with games is a little narrower, just because a game really has to appeal to me on a certain level for me to play it. And just because it's a fancy first-person shooter is usually not enough to keep my interest. One of my favorite games of all time is Shadow of the Colossus. And I'm actually quite fond of most anything that Studio Ico creates. I love Shadow of the Colossus. I love Ico. I am looking forward to Last Guardian, although I'm not sure I'm going to be as interested in the story, because both Ico and Shadow are more of a romantic story, whereas Last Guardian looks like a story of a boy and his dog, which has a sort of different story sensibility. So it looks really gorgeous, and I'm sure it'll be a lot of fun to play. I'm just not sure if I'm going to be engaged in a story level. Recently, the game that's really blown me away was Journey by that game company, because it also has a really cool cosmological arc to it, and also Dust and Elysian Tale. A number of my former voice acting students, and current voice acting students for that matter, a number of my voice acting students were cast in that game and worked on Dust and Elysian Tale. And I've only gotten to the first boss battle, but I'm really impressed with a lot of the storytelling aspects of that game as well. So I'm looking forward to maybe over the holidays getting some more time to play through Dust and see the overall arc of the story.
And we'll definitely talk about the whole teaching aspect in a little bit, but I have to ask you this. I'm looking through your video game credits, and every once in a while, you seem to be getting roles where you're taking over for an existing actor, taking normally from a movie license or something like that. And there's three roles that, taken together, just sound like it would be impossible that these three roles would be done by the same person. You've got Will Turner from the Pirates of the Caribbean series. You've got Leonidas from 300, and Myron Reducto from Harvey Birdman.
Yes, peanut poo. Shrink ray.
Yes.
So you got Stephen Colbert, you've got Gerard Butler, and you've got whatever that guy's name is, who does Will Turner. He's blanking. I can only think of him as Legolas now, which is sad, but I don't actually know what his real name is anymore.
Yeah, Orlando Bloom.
Thank you. Do you do a lot of impressions? It's like, looking through your roles, you seem to do more kind of within your speaking voice range. I mean, there are some variations, obviously, but are you called on to do a lot of impressions or impersonations or whatever you want to call them?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we don't call them impersonation; we call them voice matching.
That sounds less insulting, so I'm going to use that one now.
Well, and also it's a slightly different skill. Impersonation is really cool, But usually when you're impersonating someone, it's usually being done for comedy's sake, like you're parodying them, or you're exaggerating, or you're caricaturing them. You're exaggerating aspects of the way they speak. You know, hello, my name is James Mason. I play the voice of God. And so I can do an impersonation of James Mason. But can I voice match him? Can I perform James Mason to a level where when you hear my performance, you think it is actually James Mason? That's what voice matching is. Voice matching is not simply reciting back what another actor has done, but rather speaking as if you are that actor to a level of believability that the audience can't tell the difference. And that is the challenge of voice matching, is really nailing the character and being able to speak original dialogue that possibly that character has never said before and still make it sound consistent with the rest of the stuff you are familiar with. So every once in a while in the voiceover world, we get these auditions for voice matches, for what are called celebrity voice matches. And it turns out that I've got a pretty good ear, and there are certain celebrities that I am able to voice match well enough that they're willing to hire me to play the voice of that character when that celebrity is either not interested or unavailable or anything like that. The biggest one I've done the voice match for, or the most often common voice match I've done, is for Orlando Bloom. And that started with Pirates of the Caribbean, Disney Character Voices, the division I was talking about before. It was their job to make sure that the voices for the characters of Pirates of the Caribbean sounded good, because Disney owns those characters. Orlando Bloom and does not own Will Turner, nor does Johnny Depp own Jack Sparrow. Those are characters owned by a Disney company. So when Disney was making Kingdom Hearts 2 and they wanted to make a Pirates of the Caribbean section of the game, they wanted to make sure that those characters sounded accurate. For whatever reason, the live-action actors weren't interested in playing the characters at that time, so they needed to cast someone to voice match Johnny Depp, Orlando Bloom, Keira Knightley, and I believe Jeffrey Rush, who played Barbossa. So I auditioned and was cast as Orlando Bloom, because I can do a really good Orlando Bloom impression or voice match. And so then the Lord of the Rings guys found out about that, because the first Lord of the Rings games that I worked on, I did not play Legolas. I played Faramir, Haldir, I played the Goblin Commander, but they didn't know that I could do Orlando Bloom until it sort of came out because of the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff. But then since then, I've been doing only Legolas on the Lord of the Rings games. I haven't been allowed to play any other character. Leonidas was also a random one. I got an audition, and it said, we need the King of Sparta, and he has a Scottish accent. And I said, can't the King of Sparta have a Greek accent? I mean, wouldn't that be more accurate? Okay. But it was because of the film 300 with Gerard Butler, and so I auditioned for it. And I totally did not expect to book that job. I thought, well, clearly there's guys out there who are actually Scottish who might book this job before me. But when I got the call and said, no, you're hired, I talked to the director about it. And I said, wow, why did you hire me? There's plenty of Scots in Los Angeles. And she said, yeah, but the problem was that all the Scottish guys sounded very blue collar. They sounded like they were out of a movie like Trainspotting. They did not sound royal. They did not sound like a king. And that's another character archetype that I'm very good at performing, is royalty or aristocracy. And they said, you're Scottish performance sounded noble, sounded like a king. I said, oh, okay, interesting. With Stephen Colbert, I couldn't quite voice match Stephen Colbert as Stephen Colbert. He plays two characters on Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law. He plays a lawyer character, and then he plays the Reducto character. I couldn't quite nail his lawyer character, because Stephen Colbert has a certain resonance and rasp in his voice that I just don't have genetically. And it's very hard for me to try to mimic without having the same sort of vocal cords as he does. It almost sounds like vocal damage. But when he does Reducto, he pushes his voice into a more cartoony area. And for whatever reason, I could nail Reducto. So I think they actually get another actor to do the lawyer character, but I played Reducto. And then another voice match that I do is for Ben Stiller for Madagascar. Many times when they need someone to play Alex the Lion from Madagascar, they call me up to play Alex the Lion. So these, and then there's other voice matches that I haven't gotten because I just wasn't appropriate for. So we audition for this kind of stuff all the time, and we just book them when someone thinks we sound good enough for the role.
Excellent. Now, I mentioned you do a lot of work behind the mic, I guess. You You're the first voice director we've actually talked to on the show. You've done a couple different shows, and you're also a script writer. Now, looking at your credits, they seem to all be anime. Aren't these scripts already done? Like, what is the script writer's role on an established anime show?
Yeah, it probably shouldn't say script writer. I assume you're looking at something like a movie.
I'm on Wikipedia, which is, you know, famous on this show for being accurate at all times.
Yes, yeah, please. You can never argue with Wikipedia. It's clearly absolute truth. Oh, amen. No. They're putting in script writing, but that's not really my job. And if you look at the credits in the shows, I am not credited as the screenwriter or the script writer. I'm credited as the adapter, the script adapter. So this first started when I was working on a little show called Pokemon back in New York City. The idea is that when trying to do the dub of an anime, the production company gets the video, they hire the actors, and then they have a translator translate the Japanese script into English. However, that English translation will probably, most likely, not match lip flap, the actual lip flap of the characters on the screen. So the script adapter's job is to take that raw English translation, adapt the cultural references so that they make sense in English, make sure that the English is spoken dialogue English and not sort of written proper distant English, make sure the characters all have different sounding voices, and then match the lip flap. This is a very tricky operation to do so that it sounds natural and seamless. But it's not the same. It's actually the skills that you need to be a good script adapter are closer to directing than they are to actual writing. An actual script writer needs to figure out world and character motivations and figure out the logic of the plot and everything else. I never had to do that as a script adapter because the plot was already established. The characters were right in front of me. What I had to do is try to make the English script sound as believable and natural as possible and make sure that it elicited out of an English-speaking audience the same emotional reaction that the show would have elicited out of a Japanese audience in the original Japanese production. So it's more that I was script adapting a lot of these shows.
Was that something that you just kind of fell into that you it's almost kind of cliche where it's the actor who wants to direct? Is it just an extension of I want to do make as good a show as possible, and to do that I need to be able to direct?
It was one of the reasons why I think it started was because when I was first working on anime in New York City, all the anime productions that we were doing back then were non-union. They were not done through the Screen Actors Guild or the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors, which back then were two different unions. Those two unions have recently merged. But it wasn't union. And so at the time, while I was a member of the Theatrical Acting Union, I was not a member of SAG or AFTRA yet. So I was okay working on these non-union shows because I wasn't yet a union member. But when Pokemon came along, also because those shows that I was doing, like Slayers, Utena, Irresponsible Captain Tyler, these were being released directly to DVD. These were not being broadcast on television, and the chances of them being broadcast on television were very, very slim. But Pokemon, when it was coming down the pike, it was clear that Pokemon was going to be designed to be played on major television networks. It was designed to make a lot of money. And so I thought it was most appropriate for it to go union, and so that the actors working on it were getting union rates and union benefits and everything else. Well, the producers disagreed with me, and the entire history of Pokemon has been non-union. So I found that sort of personally offensive, and so I was not willing to voice act on a show that was going to make so much money, but sort of cut the actors out of any of the benefits of that huge windfall. And so instead, they said, well, you won't voice act on it. Will you adapt some of the scripts? And again, I wasn't a member of the Writers Guild, so I thought, okay, why not? Let me try it. Let me see what it would be like. And it was interesting for a while. And then the producers and I on Pokemon didn't see eye to eye, and luckily we went our separate ways, which is a very good thing. when I was working on other shows, what happened was is that a friend of mine was starting a dubbing studio, and we were going to be working together. And unfortunately, just before everything was going to go forward, he died of a heart attack at a very young age. And everything was going to fall apart. But the guy who owned the studio and I were friends. And so we decided to try to salvage the situation. And the only way it would work is if the studio owner directed and I adapted the scripts, if we split up the job of my friend who had just died. So I said, okay, I can do that. And so I started adapting more and more scripts. And it was in an effort to make sure that the storytelling was coming across as clearly as possible. And then when I started directing, I definitely wanted to adapt my own scripts because I was being sort of persnickety about them and I wanted them a certain way. So every time I've voice directed on an anime series, I've always adapted my own scripts. And then it became a little exhausting, physically exhausting. I actually hurt my hands because of all the typing work I was doing. And so I took a break from it. And then the only other show that I've adapted, officially adapted, was that I didn't direct, was Witch Hunter Robin. And I only adapted the second half of the show. 1 to 13, I think it was a number of different script adapters. And I was adapting my lines as one of the characters in the show on the fly. And the director said, well, do you want to adapt everybody's lines? And I thought, oh, okay, fine. And so I adapted all the scripts from 14 to 26 on Witch Hunter Robin.
Do you speak Japanese?
Do not. Well, I speak a little bit of Japanese. I speak enough Japanese to get me in trouble. But I am by no means fluent, nor am I even conversational in my in Japanese. So no, my Japanese is very limited.
So we got to talk about the classes that you're doing. Now, you do a regular workshops and things like that. And that seems to be a fairly common thing with voice actors that have been working for a while. There seems to be a very, very much kind of pay it forward mentality with a lot of voice actors. And you also do your own podcast, actually, a twice weekly thing called Voice Acting. I think it's Voice Acting Mastery. Is that what it's called?
Yes, Voice Acting Mastery. It's actually once every 2 weeks.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I got my numbers backwards.
Yep. But I die. I don't think I'd have time to do anything else. But yeah, once every 2 weeks, I release a podcast on my website and blog called Voice Acting Mastery about voice acting and what it takes to work as a professional voice actor. And the Voice Acting Mastery blog and podcast grew out of a question that I was getting at conventions all the time, and most voice actors get, which is, how do I become a voice actor? Fans always want to know, how do I become a voice actor? And the problem is that is a very simple question with a very complicated answer, because everyone is coming from very different backgrounds, everyone lives in very different parts of the country, and everyone might need to do very different things in order to accomplish becoming a paid voiceover artist. And so rather than give sort of generic one-size-fits-all answers to people that are not terribly satisfying, nor do they offer a clear path on what one should actually do, sort of practically do in order to accomplish the goal of becoming a voice actor, I thought I would start this podcast as a way to reach those who are interested in learning the mindset and the techniques that one needs to become a professional voice actor. It was also an extension of the classes. I had started offering voice acting classes in Los Angeles. And a lot of the times the way I would talk about them or promote them was through things like Twitter and Facebook. And so obviously the people who were in the Los Angeles area were very interested. And I even got some people from very far away who were willing to fly in to take class with me from Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, Canada. I've had people from all over flying into Los Angeles to work with me, to study with me. But I thought it would be great to reach those who that's not possible for them. It's not necessarily feasible for them to come to Los Angeles. So I started doing a podcast, and I also started offering online voice acting classes, which now I've been doing for the last couple of months, which has been very rewarding. And now I've had students from as far afield as the UK and Australia come and take class with me online through Voice Acting Mastery. So Voice Acting Mastery has sort of become my hub for both my blog, my podcast, any classes that I'm offering. I also have a page on the webpage that is, I call the toolbox section, which has all of my recommendations for recording gear and software and everything else. And over time, I keep expanding and developing all the different aspects of Voice Acting Mastery as I get response from my listeners and from my students about what they're interested in and what they would like to know in order to further their voice acting careers.
And all that is available at CrispinFreeman.com?
Well, no.
No. Oh.
There is a link from CrispinFreeman.com to VoiceActingMastery.com.
Aha.
Go to chrisman.com. You will see. If you are interested in learning about how to become a voice actor and taking classes with me, please visit voiceactingmastery.com. Because chrisman.com is for me as a voice actor. So when producers and directors want to hire me as a voice actor, they go to chrisman.com because that's how they know me as a voice actor by my name. And so they go there and I have my demos there. And fans may go there as well. But when they go there, I try to put a link saying, you know, it's great. chrisman.com is for me as a professional artist. This is how I represent myself as a professional artist. If you are interested in me as your teacher, as your voiceover coach, please go to voiceactingmastery.com, where everyone who is interested in pursuing voice acting professionally, that's where you go, and that's where you can dialogue with me through my blog and through my podcasts about what it takes to work as a voice actor. Because as you can imagine, directors and casting producers aren't necessarily so interested in the dialogue I'm having with my students. They're more interested in hiring me for their projects. So I do split them up that way. So there's voiceactingmastery.com and chrisman.com.
Thank you for clarifying. You've also got the Twitter and the Facebook, and the Twitter is just at Chrisman Freeman. Easy to remember.
Yep, it's true.
And your Facebook page is, I'm assuming, facebook.com/Chrisman Freeman?
Yes, I believe it is. I try to keep my name as consistent as possible. I have found that if it isn't actually my name, people don't believe it's actually me. I try. As simple as possible. Sometimes, even though I'm a hacker and I've been working on computer systems since before most of my fans were born, I always find it humorous that I don't always share the same culture online that a lot of people do, especially gaming culture. I know that people, when they sign on to Xbox Live or PlayStation Home Network, that they usually have some sort of alias, that they usually go under some sort of, you know, Ogre251 or something. I don't really do that because I don't feel the need to be anyone other than myself. So when I first got my iPhone and my iPad, and I signed into the Apple Game Center, they say, "What's your name?" And I said, "Chrisman Freeman." And they said, "Well, what's your gamer name?" And I said, "Chrisman Freeman." And the screen came up and said, "Chrisman Freeman is Chrisman Freeman." Because it expected, you know, Chrisman Freeman is Ogre256. And no, Chrisman Freeman is Chrisman Freeman. So I have been informed that that's really dorky, Chrisman. You should really come up with a cool gamer tag. And I was like, that's just not my style.
I think at this point you're enough of a celebrity where you can get away with it.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I do my best to be myself.
So you have my blessing, if that means anything.
I appreciate it.
No problem. Now, we're getting into the holiday season right now, so there's probably not a lot of public appearances, but is there anything planned for conventions or something like that in 2013?
You know, it's funny you say that. There are a number of conventions that have expressed interest in having me as a guest next year, and my agent is currently negotiating with them to work out the deal, the sort of terms of my appearance. And actually, I think there's a contract I need to sign that should be coming to me very soon, for one. But I can't really talk about them until the convention announces them. It's sort of inappropriate for me to say, also because who knows, things might fall through and might not work out. So I'm going to my chrisman.com website. I had to update recently, and it's a little simple right now. It only has my demos and a link to Voice Acting Mastery, some basic contact information. But I need to update it and put a section about what my public appearances will be. So when the contract is signed and the ink is dry, I will certainly post on my website what my convention appearances will be for 2013.
Excellent. And one final question, then we'll let you go. You've been very patient. You mentioned acting from a young age. At what point did you get or grow into the voice you have now, and how has it helped you on the dating front? Because I am 100% straight, but I kind of want to date you right now.
Well, thank you, Evan. That's very kind of you. I was not born with some sort of deep voice. It's funny. It's sometimes, even though I voice act and even though I spend all my time auditioning for parts and needing to know what kind of parts suit my voice and what kind of parts don't suit my voice, sometimes it's very hard for me to have perspective on the sound of my voice because I live with it all the time. Every time I open my mouth, this is what comes out of my mouth. And so it just, after a while, it sounds normal to me. And I forget, oh, no, I sound a little different from other people. When I was young, I did not have some sort of crazy deep voice. No one turned to me, to young Crispin Freeman, and said, oh my gosh, your voice is amazing. My voice and what I'm able to do with it now was certainly something that I developed over time, mostly through my classical acting training and also through singing training. I'm trained as a classical operatic baritone. And so through learning how to sing operatic arias and legit Broadway show tunes and things like that, I was able to develop my voice in a way that's given me a lot more expressive capability. And so that's where a lot of the resonance in my voice comes from. I mean, obviously, you are the potential of your voice has a lot to do with genetics, but the actual product of your voice has a lot to do with how you decide to develop. And so that's where the sound of my voice comes from. It's a combination of the fact that I have a pretty clear tone and I have a pretty good baritone sensibility, but I've also trained and exercised those muscles in such a way that I can now vocal produce in ways that I certainly could not before I classically trained as an opera singer. As far as the dating front, it's served pretty well, actually. That's how I got involved with my wife. The first time she knew of my existence was through my voiceover work. She heard my voice and found it intriguing, and that's how she initially found out who I was and what I was all about. So I'm pretty grateful that my voice was able to attract my mate.
There's no better way to end it than that note. Crispin Freeman, thank you again for coming on. You can, again, find his stuff on CrispinFreeman.com. You can find out his podcast series at VoiceActingMastery.com. And we're going to have links to all that stuff in the show notes. But again, Crispin, thanks for coming on, man.
You bet. Thank you, Evan. It's been a pleasure.
This has been The Voice Behind, a production of the Fancy Pants Gangsters Netcast Network. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode, and for outtakes from this and other episodes, as well as news and commentary from the voice actor community, follow our Twitter feed at twitter.com/thevoicebehind or on Facebook at facebook.com/thevoicebehind. Comments, questions, and suggestions are more than welcome at voice@fancypantsgangsters.com. Thanks so much for listening.